All right, this is Joseph Klett with Jody Roberts. We're sitting beginning the oral history with Sandra Harding. We are here in her home in Los Angeles in the Playa Vista neighborhood. And it is April 23, 2019. So if we could begin, could you tell us about where you're born and raised?
I was born in San Francisco in the depth of the Depression, March 29th, 1935. And my father had already had trouble finding work. He had had many different jobs. He was a plumber, he was an electrician, he was an assistant to Miss Jean Pittman, Pittman's shorthand. He was an assistant to Frank Galbraith of Time Budget Studies. He was a man of all trades, but couldn't find stable employment during the Depression. And so in San Francisco, he worked various jobs. I don't know exactly what, plumber, electrician, something. And then things got really bad, and my sister was born. And so in 1937, they moved down to Los Angeles, to Sunland. And they moved in with great Aunt Ruby. So this was my father's aunt or great aunt. I think it was my father's great aunt, my father's great aunt. Her father or grandfather, I can't track it exactly, had been a 49er who hadn't found any gold but had settled in Sunland. Mm-hmm. And so it was a beautiful orange orchard up against the hills. I have a very romantic watercolor painting of it in my bathroom, I'll show you. So we lived, my sister was a couple months old, 1937, and so my father worked as a real estate agent, did various catch-me-as-you-can jobs, but was fundamentally unemployed for a good part of the time, and built a cafe on the side of the road there. It was on, not 210, is it 210? Foothill Boulevard. Okay. And going through Sunland. Where we lived is now condominiums, but the park across the street is just as it was. Mm-hmm. And, maybe 20 years ago, I went into the park community room or something, and there was a caretaker there. And I started chatting with him, and it turned out his wife and I had been in the same kindergarten. He was a Latino guy in there. So that park was there. So to move a little bit quickly, they ran this coffee shop for, 5 years or something like that. And it was on the main trucking route into Los Angeles from that direction, so they had a steady supply of clients, and my mother cooked, and my father eventually built a little kind of a cottage on the back for my sister and me, and great Aunt Ruby was, I have a wonderful photo of her. I'm 5 and she's 95 or something like that. And for her, fashions had hit their absolute peak around 1880. So she's holding my hand and we're looking at these palm trees in front of the cottage. She has on her 1895 clothes, and I'm 5 years old. And the photo's from behind. And we inherited the equivalent of that photo at 10-year intervals from 1850 on, when those palm trees were first in coffee cans, and then we see them growing up through the years. So then the war starts in 1942, and my father got a job in the civil service on the East Coast.
Can we pause for a second?
Yeah.
What is your father's name?
My father's name is Lloyd Edward Everett Harding.
And what was your mother's maiden name?
My mother's maiden name was Constance forget her middle name. Kimber.
Kimber was the last name?
Mm-hmm.
And the diner, was this just Depression-era ingenuity, or did they have a background in running a restaurant?
Nope.
They worked in one?
Nope. They figured everybody needs food, so... I mean, that's the way it was in the Depression. Let me just enter a couple of interesting things about my parents. My mother grew up in an orphanage from the age of 7, I think, with her 3 siblings. Even though both her parents were alive, and her father was already a very distinguished financier. He became an undersecretary of the Treasury in the Wilson administration and taught finance at NYU, and I just lent out a book of his that I ordered from the Library of Congress. They reprinted important books from that were in public domain already, and a couple of his were among them, and that was very interesting, too. I never even knew his name. He was so hated in our household. He was only referred to as A.W. Turns out his name was Albert William Kimber. But so my mother grew up without a family, not in a traditional family. And in a way, so did my father, because his father died in a diving accident in Illinois when he was 8, I think. And his mother remarried, and the new husband was not fond of the kids by the first marriage, so they were sent out to live with Aunt Ruby. And I have a photograph of his older sister, who died as a teenager, I never met her, teaching school when she was, I think, 12. And there's her and her 4 six-year-old students in the class. So both of them suffered the vagaries of households at that particular historical era. And so when they came to do family, they didn't exactly have models. So they kind of did it the way Hollywood would do it. They were the best parents. All the other kids were so envious of us and our parents. They so loved family and so tried to make it work. It's a lovely inheritance in a certain painful, kind of painful way.
So, I was going to ask, why was Aunt Ruby out there?
Why was Aunt Ruby?
Yeah, in California.
She was a descendant of the 49er.
Okay, right.
I think she was, could she have been the daughter? She would have been born around, my father was born in 1895, and so she would have been, she could have been the daughter of the 49er.
Okay.
I have a family tree somewhere, but I can't remember what generation that is.
Is there more story on your mother's side of that they shared about how they ended up in the orphanage, or?
Yes, my grandfather A.W., as he was referred to in the household by my mother and grandmother, ran off with a secretary. My grandmother had been his secretary. She had been the first woman court stenographer in New York. And so they lived in Brooklyn. There was an older brother, Adrian, my mother, Constance, and then 2 younger sisters, the youngest of which was born in a reunion between them when the rest were already in the orphanage. And so she had no way to support the children. And they were picked up off the streets of Brooklyn by, as my grandmother always referred to them, the Papists, Catholic charities. And so that was intolerable to my grandmother. And so so she got them into this orphanage up outside Poughkeepsie. And at one point in my years of camp following my professor husband, he was teaching at Vassar, and the orphanage was about 20 minutes away. And this is, my mother's now 60, maybe 70. She was visiting, and we went over to it. And when we got there, the young woman, who when she went in at age 8, this young woman had been 15 or something, she'd been the daughter of the owner of it, And this little family came in, two girls and a boy, and then a third girl arrived. And she kind of adopted this 15-year-old, kind of adopted this family, and I'm going to get weepy. My mother and she, they hadn't seen each other for whatever, 25 years, 30 years, something like that. They threw their arms around each other. She was now the director of it, and it was no longer an orphanage. It was a home for court-appointed kids or something. I forget what it was. But, you know, that I think that this, I've always had a deep melancholy that's kind of related to my mother's deep melancholy. I mean, it's not anything surface. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was never depressed that I knew. I mean, maybe she was, but... and I've never been depressed, but there's, you carry something of those kinds of painful events that your parents can't talk about. And, so,
was the I didn't say your grandmother. Grandmother had a problem with the Catholics. Was it the religion of the orphanage that was the issue, or was it just the fact of sending kids off to the orphanage?
The orphanage was fine. The orphanage was run by Harry Emerson Fosdick. Do you know who he is? He was the he's a very famous in the 1920s and 30s, and he appears back in my life at a later point, two later points, I'll tell you. He wrote a very famous book. It was lying around my house when I in the 1940s called "How to Win Friends and Influence People." And he was he's a pastor who'd been head of the First Baptist Church in New York and founded Riverside Church and turned it into an ecumenical Protestant church, which was the first of the sort. And so the orphanage was run by, had been set up by this guy who was ecumenical. My grandparents were just prejudiced against Catholics. And my mother carried a little bit of that. I mean, it wasn't a visible thing, except that the lady next door to us liked very black tea. And my mother always said, she drinks tea the way the Irish do. I wouldn't drink it that way. And I don't know. You know, that's the blacks of the early part of the 20th century, right, with the Italians and the Irish. And so they shared that to some extent. On the other hand, in their overt... kind of civil rights selves, they were very progressive. My father appointed the first Jew and the first black to the local school board. He was very disappointed when I brought home a couple of those guys as dates in college. This was not his idea of how this should work out. He was polite and kept his views to himself. So if kids can figure out a way to really annoy their parents, they'll figure it out.
Yeah. In your, you had written this piece in Work in Politics, this chapter you shared with me, and you had mentioned you that you what you absorbed from your father was his fascination with how things work, his respect for working people's knowledge, and social inequality, if only in local contexts. And I underline that because I think this
that's what
you're
I mean.
Getting at that point, right?
Yeah, he was a good liberal.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean. It's a limited position.
Yeah.
It's,
right.
But for his era, that was. He was progressive. And when he worked at Fort Monmouth, so he arrived at Fort Monmouth in 19... So he came to Camp Evans originally when we moved east. It had been Camp Evans. It's Sandy Hook State Park. Now on New Jersey, it's that hook of land up there across from Manhattan.
Okay.
But it had been a big radar station in World War II. And it was an outpost of Fort Monmouth. And so... we lived on the Jersey Shore, and he worked there. And then when Camp Evans shut, he moved to Fort Monmouth. And that was in the era of McCarthyism, and two of his friends committed suicide during the McCarthy. McCarthy was picking on Communist Party members, and especially at Fort Monmouth. And my father was not a socialist. My brother was in the CP, and my brother was one of the founders of... SDS. And my father loved him, but the political distance between them was humongous. Because a kid will figure out how to really annoy their parents in the worst possible way.
Politics. could you name your siblings?
I had three sisters and a brother. One sister died, and so I now have two sisters and a brother.
She died in childbirth or later?
No, she just died of, I think she had a heart attack and a stroke and died of a bunch of things when she was 65.
Okay. Could you name them in birth order?
Yes. So there's 12 and a half years between me and the youngest. The sister who died is the next one, Rosamond. She was born in 1937. Victoria, Vicky, who lives in New York City now and has kids and so forth, was born in 1942. David was born in 1945. And Constance Joy, referred to by us as Joy, was born in 1947.
So, when did you leave Sunland for New Jersey?
1942.
42, okay.
We actually moved to Tahunga for a year or two there, I forget why, and then from Tahunga. They're nearby, they're very close.
In LA?
Yeah, out in the hills there. So I did kindergarten and half of first grade and then second grade here. And then in 1942 moved east and started third grade in Bradley Beach, New Jersey. And I'm going to tell you a very funny thing that has nothing to do with this story.
Okay.
So 1942, I'm in Bradley Beach, New Jersey. A friend of mine here, her name is Eleanor Leibesman. The guy she's married to is in assisted living over there. He has Parkinson's. It's the bottom two floors there are the assisted living. He and I were in the same classroom from second grade through eighth grade in Bradley Beach, New Jersey. Isn't that weird?
That's wild.
It's very weird. So watch out. Your pasts come around in unexpected ways.
Maybe we've been downstairs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So could you maybe just paint a picture of what your childhood was like in these elementary years for you? Obviously, your siblings are at different stages, but... You moved to New Jersey, your parents have another couple kids. What's your everyday life like?
So, I had to babysit them all, so they all hate me in some level. It was a pretty good childhood. It was a lovely childhood. We lived in a neighborhood. It was very much a neighborhood. We could play out on the street. We played basketball in other kids' backyards, and people were running in and out of the parents were looking over whoever was in sight. We lived three blocks from the beach, so we spent a lot of time on the beach. I grew up body surfing and just loved the beach. My parents believed in lessons. So I had tap dance lessons. I had ballet lessons from when I was four until I was 16. I had piano lessons from four until 17. I was a twirler in high school. You know, twirler?
Mm-hmm. Lead the band, right?
Pardon?
You lead the band.
You lead, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think of myself as having had a very happy childhood. I had a lot of friends. And did my freshman year in one local high school. And then the family had been renting houses in Bradley Beach, and then they got enough money together to buy a house and move 10 miles south. To Brielle, New Jersey, which is the beginning of the inland waterway down to Florida. It's a boat culture. You never have to go out on the ocean. You go into the Chesapeake Bay and there are canals and whatnot. I mean, maybe you have to go out on the ocean for a mile or something, and then you. So the whole place was a boat culture, and I had a sailboat. But by this time, I'm talking high school, and had. Friends and started to have boyfriends and not sure what else to say about it. We spent a lot of time on the beach.
When you were back here in California before you went east, were you helping at all with the cafe, with the coffee shop?
I was seven when we left.
So did you help out at all? Or?
No, I sat up at the counter and read the soup cans. I was an easy reader.
Yeah.
They didn't have me. They didn't want me around dangerous kitchen
appliances
or anything. And I was too young to do any waiting or anything.
And when you moved east, did your mom had been working, helping out with the diner.
Mm-hmm.
What was she doing while your father joined the civil service?
Having children.
Every 2 years?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Vicky, she had a lot of miscarriages.
Mm-hmm.
So Vicky was born in 42 and David in 45 and Joy in 47, so she had 5 kids.
Yeah.
And she did go back to work when? When the youngest kid got into school on a full day, she started working as a substitute teacher and eventually as a school librarian. And she did that for many years.
Did she have a particular subject that she taught?
No, I think she taught at the very low grades, kindergarten, first grade, second grade.
So you didn't encounter her in your own school?
In my own school?
Yeah.
No.
So, during this period, what were your... I'm curious about your first recognition of this thing called science and what your early impressions were of that.
Not good. I hated chemistry in high school. I can't remember. I must have taken physics. Oh, yeah, I remember when I was in college. We had this horrific teacher. He was really crazy. I took almost no science. I had no relationship to science, except that my father was an engineer. So he was always fixing things. And I was the eldest kid, and he just longed for a son.
Mm-hmm.
And so for 10 years, I got to be his son. So he played bass, taught me to play baseball, until my brother came along 10 years later, right? And so I was always fixing things with him. And so it's really engineering more than science that I had a relationship to.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't particularly have a relationship to science now, apart from gardening and so forth. And I, as you know, didn't come into this field through a background in science, but rather through philosophy of knowledge production, fundamentally.
It sounds like your sense of science at that time was as sort of like a sort of an academic.
Yeah, it was a school
definition.
Topic.
Yeah, the school topic. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
When did you realize that engineering and science were intimate fields or intimate activities?
I don't think that was. I mean, I did know they were intimate, but I don't remember a moment when that thought came to me or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was just allergic to science. I mean, also teachers were terrible in those days around girls in math and science. I can remember 7th and 8th grade, the math teacher would not call on the girls in the class because she said, "You're not as smart as the boys." So when we raised our hands, she told us what she was doing.
Hmm.
"I'm only going to call on the boys because the girls aren't smart enough."
Hmm.
I mean, you know, the whole world was, this is before feminism, right? I mean, the whole world was, I mean, there were, just to expand this issue, when I went into philosophy, there were almost no women in philosophy. In the generation above me, there were maybe 2 or 3 who wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth Barkin Marcus, a logician. I can't think of the names of the others. I mean, there were probably plenty in the black colleges and in the Catholic colleges, but not in the private white colleges or the big state university systems. So at the American Philosophical Association, my generation of graduate student, and I'm 10 years older than most of them because I went back to graduate school late, we were mentoring each other. And you know, when I entered, the women's movement was forming. This is the next stage, so I won't go into it. But, you know, when I entered graduate school, I entered in 68 in sociology. I was living in SUNY Albany, and I didn't want to go into my husband's department. And I didn't want to go into English, which I had been an English major as an undergraduate, and edited the literary magazine, and was a reporter for the paper, and so forth. I didn't want to go into English because I'd learned that was the era of new criticism, where there was, it's the equivalent of analytic philosophy, I don't know how to tell. And there's a few, the history went through, it was a post-World War II isolation of the formal elements of these disciplines from any historical or cultural background. Mm. It's what all the critics of STS were trained up in. Mm. Right, so if you're looking at any cultural or historical phenomenon, that's interesting, but it has nothing to do with the content. So we analyzed words and sentences quite apart from the context in which they were produced, any meanings they might have that laid outside the text. So I wasn't about to go into that because I learned to enjoy novels again 13 years later. So I picked sociology, but then the department at SUNY Albany was great at producing quantitative master's graduates. And I'm one of the few philosophers who's taken a statistics course, and I loved it. Because meanwhile, I'd been grading my husband's logic papers from his students, right? And I'd gotten into it, and statistics was a lot of fun. But I couldn't, I was interested in sociological theory. I wanted Marx and Weber and Durkheim and all the big guys. And my advisor gave me the equivalent of cliff notes on each one of them. And I was outraged in graduate school to get cliff notes on Max Weber and Durkheim and the others, Talcott Parsons. So the easiest next university for me to, I mean, Yale was actually physically closer, but it was really hard to get there from Albany. So I looked at NYU because they had a very good, at that time, social theory set of faculty in sociology. And so this is how I ended up in philosophy. The sociology graduate courses met three times a week for 2 hours each. I looked over in the catalog, and the philosophy department courses, no, they met twice a week for 2 hours each. The philosophy department graduate courses met once a week for 4 hours, or 3 hours, I guess it was. So I switched to philosophy because I
and then commute once. Yes.
I mean, I'd already been socialized into the discipline because I'd married a philosopher, right? And so it was really easy. I mean, I knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And I was in the first generation of returning women students, which NYU had a particularly large supply of because so many women were for family reasons, attached to the area. Their husbands were teaching or whatever they were doing in the area, so they couldn't go elsewhere. But NYU was not as highly ranked a graduate program as it has subsequently become. But it was a good one, and it was possible for us to do the degree there. So that's when I began taking back my maiden name, Harding.
Where did your desire for social theory come from? Like, you, as you say, like, science wasn't the calling.
I think partly the civil rights movement and feminism, the 60s. I was actually not involved in marching around the streets in the 60s because I was either had babies or I was in graduate school. My babies were born in 95 and 96. My babies are now 52 and 53. But the spirit was there, and the women's movement was very interested in social theory, obviously. And in Albany, New York, there were something like 30 colleges within an hour of downtown Albany, so there was all kinds of women's organizing. And New York had a liberalized abortion law 3 years before Roe v. Wade, and it was the state capital. So there was a huge, and the civil rights movement was very active in Albany and had a big black population. So there was a lot of marching around the streets and capital study groups and the whole apparatus of 60s intellectual social theory. So I think my whole career has really, my career, you know, as a once I got out of grad school, has really ridden the crest of the social justice movements. It's very much taken its impetus from them, and I've always intended to work for them, to provide the kind, I mean, strong objectivity was done not out of abstract interest in it, but because the social justice movements needed a way to argue that their work was objective, more objective than the racist and classist and sexist and eventually ableist and homophobic and so forth and other movements, theories. And so I designed those. I've always designed my writing projects to serve as, number one, to be taught. So they have to be in a language that you can teach at the upper level undergraduate or in graduate courses. I mean, they don't always work that way, but that's been the goal. And they have to be of service to the social movements. And so I think I just was in that moment in history when that was happening. I mean, the same thing happened around this post-colonial stuff.
Yeah,
it just started to happen.
So so knowing where we end up in the 60s, then, I want to, because we kind of leapt over the
50s. Yes, we did.
So the question about science and eventually social theory is really about role models, mentorship. Where were you seeing, you've cited your parents, both of them, and their... both what they lived through and what you witnessed them live through and the sort of their enduring attitude from this. Were there other sources, were there other professionals or other teachers or folks who gave you some kind of inspiration to eventually find your way into philosophy and social theory?
Well, my writing always got praised. And in elementary school, my seventh grade teacher wrote, you know, those old books that the students take around, I forget what they call them. Mrs. McInerney wrote in it, "You will be a great writer." And I looked at that page for years, and I didn't know what it meant. And I later came, she saw something. And I loved writing, and I still love writing much too much. I write too much. But there's something about that azure screen. And thoughts start to look true when they're up on it, right? Compared to before the screens, my manuscripts had these strips of typed paper taped to, you know, the revision process was not like it is now. So I think my writing always got praised. And then the minute I did start writing professionally, I was writing for these social movements. And as I say, we mentored each other. I mean, there's a few faculty I could mention who were, you know, useful, but they weren't serious mentors all the way along or anything. And frequently they were discouraging. I can remember as a graduate student getting papers back. My doctoral dissertation had one little check on page 73. No comments. I'd get straight A's in everything, but no feedback from the faculty. And I still see that happening in graduate schools. I think it's a hugely irresponsible thing. And I always made my students publish before they got their doctorate. I mean, I give them feedback all the time. And one graduate student told me once as she was leaving my office, she said, "Sandra, we graduate students, after we meet with you, we always go out in the hallway and cry." I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." She said, "But you're the only professor who gives us honest feedback on our work." And I always tried to be tough love, to be really clear about what they needed to do, but to give them all the support I could for doing it. But I probably didn't do the last part as much as I should have. So where we mentored each other.
Like what sort of literacy? Like, I'm wondering, like, what sort of, was it fiction? Was it the great novels? Was it pulp? Like, or were you reading more?
Well, I was an English major in college and complete
What's the prehistory of that? So, like, you're obviously the assignments were pleasing your elementary school teachers. What were you reading to influence your
all writing? Of Shakespeare in one 10-week course. All the Shakespeare major plays in 10-week course. What were we reading? I don't know that I... one advisor I had, Fred Brantley. He paid attention to my work, and it was complimentary at the same time that he was a little dangerous. I had boyfriends, so he always wanted to hear, are they good to you? I mean, can you imagine? So I was reading everything. I mean, I had 60 English credits as an undergraduate. You're only supposed to have 30. But I just took every literature course. I just liked reading all of it, so I don't know, I took everything. And I read novels, lots of novels.
Do you have a favorite author?
I love Jane Austen. I read all my way through Jane Austen, I think, 3 times. This was later. I mean, I read her once in college, but later I read them all, Hemingway, and, you know, whatever. I haven't read a novel now in probably 20 years, maybe 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Is that on purpose?
The material I read on colonialism is like, it's like reading a novel all the time. There's all these villains and victims and retribution and exotic locales and parts of history you never knew about. I find all my novelistic pleasures completely satisfied by this post-colonial literature. And meanwhile, I really just like analyze, I really like the analytic part of philosophy, not in the way that it was taught then, but trying to figure out what's going on here that's not so visible on the surface.
I'm thinking, like, as you know, you cite it to mention Jane Austen, for example. It's, you know, it's a lot of manners, it's a lot of social conventions, right? Like, you kind of need to know the stakes of those stories to appreciate them. Right? And so I could see how that would translate well into a social theory.
That's interesting.
Right? Especially when you've got large casts. You know, cast of players.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Siblings and things.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
All those political dynamics that are happening in these stories.
No, I took everything. Greek and Roman literature. I mean, whatever they offered, I took it.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious, even earlier than that, so keep maybe scrolling back. You know, you're a child of the Depression.
Yeah.
Your parents have themselves very unstable childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
You said, you know, you took lessons, you know, there was a lot of kind of idyllic family kind of nurturing going on. But what was the imagined outcome for you as a life path or a career path? Either foisted upon you or for yourself?
Well, my parents had very different visions. But let me tell you something first. I remember, I think it was the summer I was 12. So the little local library was a 3-block walk. And the librarian would only let me take out 2 books a day. I couldn't take out any more. And so I'd take them out and I'd bring them back in 2 days, right? And I spent one whole summer trying to read my way through the fiction section. I started with A, and I just read everything. I just read them in order. And I sat out under the hydrangea bushes in the front yard so my mother wouldn't find me and make me come in and take care of the kids. And I just read novels. It was all trash and good novels. I mean, whatever came up in the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got up to L in 3 months. I mean, it wasn't a big library, but that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So let me see, you were asking, what was your question?
Just kind of, what did you imagine doing?
Yeah.
Imagination
about it. My mother had to make a case to my father. My father thought that girls could be a nurse or a teacher or a secretary. And that's what he wanted. He didn't want me to go to college. He wanted me to go to one of those other schools. And my mother had graduated from Elmira College, which out of the orphanage, which was the first college to give Phi Beta Kappa to women. And she'd been Phi Beta Kappa. And she had to convince him that I could go to the local, you know, Douglas College and Rutgers University, which was about an hour away. So I don't think I had any career senses at that point. And I didn't have much sense in college. In the 1950s, there wasn't much sense given to women about any kind of careers, except secretaries, mothers. And indeed, I think in my graduating class at Douglas in 1956, how many kids were in that class? I think there were about 150 in that class. It wasn't huge. I'd be surprised if there were four who went to graduate school at that point. I mean, others have gone back later. Four out of 150. I mean, quite a few were married already by the time they graduated. A couple had kids. I didn't have a sense of it. And I really didn't after college either. I worked in New York and then in Poughkeepsie for 12 years or something like that. I graduated in 56 and I went back to graduate school in 67 in sociology and 68 in philosophy at NYU. So 67, 50. 6 to 67, that's 11 years or something like that. Right. Just in one New York, you know, typical English major, fancy secretary type job. I worked for 4 years in the legal rights division of the American Broadcasting Company when that was the first, I took the first television law course offered in the country at NYU. So this is 56 and TV is just getting going and the three big networks and so forth. After 4 years, my husband and I went to Europe for, I don't know, a couple months. So I quit that job, and when I came back, I got a job working as the assistant to the president of the Keedick Lecture Bureau, which was, I think, maybe the second oldest lecture bureau in the country. It dated back. His father had founded it in the Chautauqua days. You know, the Chautauquas all over the East Coast. These big summer, they were educational projects, big auditoriums, and you'd have famous novelists and Amundsen and Scott, polar explorers, and whoever coming. They were popular education. And he had founded the Keedick Lecture Bureau. The father had founded the Keedick Lecture Bureau. And I worked as his assistant for 4 years, and I wrote publicity, and I wrote letters, and I mean, I didn't have any, I can't help it, have as a young woman of my era. And I mean, the only, when I came to back to go to graduate school, so my kids were born when I was 30 and 31, and that's 1965 and 66. And I was living in Albany, New York. And what was I doing? I was teaching something or other. One kid was born in Poughkeepsie and the second one was born in Albany. So that year with two babies was the first year in my life since I'd been five that I hadn't been either in school or working. And nobody was speaking English to me all day long. There were just these little babies. And then my husband would come home from SUNY Albany. And after a year, so meanwhile, the women's movement had started up, right? And so a group of us started meeting. And they were other faculty wives for the most part. Or the first women faculty at SUNY Albany. They were the first, they were offering the first courses in the English department on women's literature. A couple of these already had their degrees, but others with small children my friend Gloria also had kids who were a few years older than one, and she had gone back to grad school. So we elderly women, age 31 and 32, were starting back to grad school, which was the first time that the professors had this experience of older women coming back to school. And they were, I had professors who were younger than me. They were arrogant. They were really something. It was an experience. But I had my colleague group, so we were mentoring each other on how to do this.
When did you think about going back to graduate school? You mentioned earlier
right
that
then.
When you were at SUNY Albany?
Yeah, and my friends were, oh my God, they were teaching their kids to read when they were three. They were taking them to ballet lessons every day. It was like, I thought, no way, this is not a life for me. So a couple of my friends were starting back to grad school at that moment. And so they, I can remember Gloria and I talking about it. She had just started, and I started back the next year. And yeah, so I went to grad school for 5 years, getting my doctorate in 73, I think it was. And that's, it just was a product of that 1950s.
It's interesting to me because you had a mother who went to college.
Yes.
And
but
so
that's the 1920s.
Right.
That was the first woman's movement.
It's not impossible to imagine going to college, but your father is also, so you're almost playing out this sort of dichotomous thinking on what women could do.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like almost the way you're describing it, like tears are being unlocked.
Yeah.
But not, it's not, we can do anything.
No.
Girl power is,
no.
Well, women have done this, so we can do that too. And it almost seems kind of halting in its movement.
Yeah, because there was nobody ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Who was mentoring us and pulling us up in. There just wasn't.
Yeah.
For me. I mean, there were people who appreciated my writing. There were people who appreciate this, that, or the other thing. But they were not, as I said, philosophy was pitiful. I mean, there were a few more women in sociology, but not a lot. I mean, it was different in different disciplines.
Right. So you started Douglas College in 52.
Yeah.
Was there much, and you're 17, so was there much, it doesn't seem like there was much turmoil in you going to college.
Once my mother convinced my father, it was fine.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a money issue, so I worked my way through college.
Where is Douglas College?
In New Brunswick.
Okay,
New Jersey is on one side of New Brunswick, and Rutgers is on the other side. It was an hour
and
between.
That was an hour from your home.
And that was an hour from my home.
And so you major in English and comparative lit.
Mm-hmm. I edited the literary magazine for 2 years. I was president of the English Majors Club. I got straight A's and everything. Had a wonderful time.
And was that about working, or was that about just loving the experience?
Just loving the experience. And I, of course, was away from, I had boyfriends in high school, but Rutgers was on the other side of town, and my parents were a long ways away.
Mm-hmm.
So freshman year, I think I had, I forget what it was, I counted it up. I only did blind dates. I only dated guys once my entire freshman year. it was a whole different, to have, I mean, Rutgers was a huge men's college.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all the fraternities and the parties, and there was both the Douglas College was also only 45 minutes from Princeton. So I dated Princeton guys and Rutgers guys. I had a wonderful time.
Mm-hmm.
I was a good girl, but I did have a good time.
Could you say something about, you know, the 50s and the experience of that being Cold War and what was it like going to college during that period in ways beyond your studies and your
I don't think I thing. Understood the Cold War until much later. I mean, I got a few little pieces of it from, you know, my father's friends committed suicide. But I didn't know those friends. They weren't ones he I mean, they were friends of his at work at Fort Monmouth, but they weren't close, really close friends. And I wasn't big on reading newspapers in college. I didn't get into that until later. I don't know, that news was, I can't imagine it now, but it was another world, right? My world was circumscribed by the whole college activities. I don't think, I sense that we were asking, we college women were asking for things that we had to struggle for at the university. We finally got them to let us into, we had to wear a skirt to dinner every night. So some of us just hung a skirt up on the coat rack and put it on over what, our jeans or whatever we had on. But, you know, it was in between the, it was the beginning of the end in some ways. The 60s weren't there yet. I don't think, I didn't have a very good sense of the 50s until much later. I mean, the new criticism, which is was in one form or another, appeared in all of the discipline, all of the social sciences and humanities, this refusal to look at the historical cultural context of intellectual work. I was very excited by it because it was this whole new thing, and it was exciting stuff, and Professor Brantley was writing about it in the New Yorker, and I was in his short story writing class, and, you know, I didn't have any understanding of the world, I would say. It was just really limited.
Can I go one more time kind of back before college? Based on that, just thinking about what dinner conversation, what household conversation was like. Because you mentioned the part about your father's friends committing suicide during the McCarthy era, that your brother was very active in the
students.
Socialist Party work. Were there politics discussed? What was your sense of
at our dinner table?
Just in the home, or informally, or more formally?
Not much. I can't, except for my father's criticism of David, and of course David was critical of me. I mean, as a younger brother would be of his older sister. If you're so left, how come you're not down at the factory working with the women in the factory? How come you're just writing this nice stuff in your, this was later, after college? I don't remember politics being discussed. What would that have been? Eisenhower? I have no recollection who was president in 52 or 56. Summers I went home and worked. Where did I work? I worked in the telephone company as an operator 1 year, 2 years actually. I did that in high school. Then I worked as a waitress, I think, for the rest of the high school years, and I paid my own. I mean, tuition was incredibly cheap. And I think it was $400 a year or something like that at Douglas. And then I moved to New York when I was 21, and still wasn't involved in politics. I rented an apartment in the Village with two friends, and we had literary soirees and invited. I mean, I had a wonderful time, but I can't remember. Dinner table conversations were about the neighborhood and about people we knew in common, and all my younger sisters and brothers' activities. And, they weren't very located in the larger world. I don't remember that. I think we were purposely protected from it in some ways.
When you mentioned, early on, you mentioned your father including minorities in positions of leadership. Were these things that he ever discussed when you were younger, of like, I can't believe this guy at work believes this thing? And did you get a sense of his
No,
his
he
sort
was
of
very proper. He wouldn't be considered an older father now. I was 40 when he was born. But he was then. And he was almost 13 years older than my mother. And he was very proper. I mean, he had been a farm boy and then a very class advancing young man in the 1920s in New York. But no, they just had a struggle to keep. We were poor when we grew up. We had, there was always food on the table, but there wasn't a lot of money for anything else. And my mother made a lot of our clothes, sewed them on the sewing machine and so forth. And a lot of topics were just never discussed, like divorces or a parent of a friend who committed suicide. Or, I mean, it was a kind of constrained, waspish world in some ways, in retrospect, I think.
There's a line you use in in Work in Politics, and you were talking about your parents, and you say that I think you're saying you inherited the cautious but principled optimism with which they weathered their lives. And I was curious about that. Of why do you think they remained optimistic, considering the struggles that they met?
I think they loved each other so much, and they loved the family. And they didn't have any sense that it was their fault that they were poor. I mean, they could see what the world was. I mean, my childhood was very full of love, of being loved. And we had other relatives. We had aunts and so forth. Not a lot, but we had a few. My grandmother lived with us for a while. But I don't... So cautious but optimistic. Because I think they had a lot of hopes for us, and they were making it. It was a struggle, but they kept food on the table, and they got us all into college. And so I think they were proud of us, and they were proud of each other, and the whole neighborhood was like that. I mean, so, you know, they had friends all over the neighborhood and friends at work and so forth. And I don't know what they thought about McCarthyism, or I mean, I don't ever remember those as topics of conversation. They were cautious because you never knew what would happen, right? I mean, whether it was health-wise or politically or economically or...
But there was a sense of agency there.
Yes.
You could determine your fate to some degree.
And
they were doing well doing it.
And my father had been in World War I. I didn't mention that, but he was too old to be drafted in World War II, but in World War I, he went in the last year of the war, 1919, when did the war end? In 1919? Maybe he went in 1918 to 1920, something like that, and he was an aerial photographer, flying these rickety little planes. He swore they dropped bricks on each other. I can't believe that. That was some of their weapons. They'd fly over the German airplanes and drop them.
Oh, okay.
He made up stories all the time, so I'm not sure about some of these. But
sounds like it could be true.
Exactly.
They were rickety planes.
And he would be lying on his belly in the back with a camera, right, shooting aerial shots of the Loire Valley. And, you know, he was stationed in France in World War I. So he had seen a lot of the world. He'd worked on a banana boat and the Caribbean, and I mean, he was very adventuresome by nature, but also there were those opportunities. He had us, when it snowed, he had us take off our shoes and all walk barefoot in the snow. He said it was an important experience for us. And the neighbors, my mother was so embarrassed. We were all out there in our heavy winter outfits, except no shoes. We're walking around in the front yard and dragging the 4-year-old. I think the 2-year-old was relieved of this duty, but the rest of us. So we had a lot of kind of scientific spirit, I would say, a certain adventuresome educational experience.
It's also that depiction of him looking through a plane in the 19-teens, right?
Yeah.
And seeing the world, that's an extremely rare perspective to have access to.
Yes, that's true.
And I feel like that, it sounds like he's seen a lot. No pun intended, he's seen a lot in his life.
That's true, he had. Because that was the era of go west, young men, and so forth and so on. You know, it was a that particular era in American history where there was a lot of destabilization of families and urban development. And I mean, from born in 1895 in Illinois through to 1935 when I was born, that 40 years was a huge shifts in the American economy and politics, and one world war and another one about to start. Yeah, they had a kind of, I think their love of each other gave them powerful energies, and of us. And they'd survive through all my mother's miscarriages. I think she had about 5, actually. You know, those were the days when they didn't know how to deal with that more effectively. So she had 5 kids, and I think she had 5 miscarriages. And they lived through all that. So they managed to keep their health, and we were all moderately healthy, and the kinds of bad things that befell other people didn't befall us. And they got us to college.
Did all your siblings go to college as well?
Excuse me?
Did all of your siblings go to college?
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, David was at Johns Hopkins in engineering his freshman year. He dropped out to help found SDS. And he didn't go back to college for another 15 years. And then he went. I was so angry at him. He went to a black college. He took a place, a white guy, at a black college. I knew the black college. I'm forgetting the name of it. It's in Baltimore. So anyway, he went back and got a degree later.
So I wanted to return to your decision after college to move to New York City. You're working for ABC, and you're 23, and you're doing these sort of literary salons. 21 when you moved there. 23 when you meet your who becomes your husband.
23 when we get married.
Oh, when you get married. Okay. Could you tell us about when you met your husband? What was his name?
Yeah.
And all those things.
So his name is Harold Morick, M-O-R-I-C-K, and he's a philosopher. And when I met him, he was a graduate student at Columbia in philosophy. And I told you I'd come back to Harry Emerson Fosdick, right? Mm. So first of all, my parents met at Riverside Church during the Depression. My father was head of the Theater Guild. The church ran a whole bunch of social services during the Depression for people. So my father was head of the Theater Guild, met my mother, and they ran away to California. So years later, so I'm living in New York. My parents are living down in New Jersey. And there's a reunion of the Theater Guild up at Riverside. Parents invited me to come. So I joined them, and there's, to me, all these old geezers wanted to dance with me, right? I'm whatever, 25, and they're 60. And Hal ran the elevator there. He grew up right around there. His parents ran a delicatessen that was called the Columbia. It wasn't called it informally, it was the Columbia Delicatessen under 124th Street and Broadway. And so he was the elevator operator. We met in the elevator at Riverside Church and started dating. So where was I working at that point? Oh, so I was working for ABC. I was dating lots of other people. We had soirees and invited all the handsome young men we met to them and did play readings. And it was the village, right, in the 1950s. It was a lot of fun.
And what was the attraction or the common denominator?
Oh my God, he was writing his he'd written his master's on Camus, and he was writing his dissertation on Wittgenstein. And he was very tall, dark, and handsome. what's not to like?
Had you read Camus, and did you have a sense of...
Pardon?
Had you read Camus yourself and thought, well, if he's...
No.
Scrutinizing...
But I ended up typing three times his doctoral dissertation. I could never take a course on Wittgenstein and Camus when I went to grad school. There was no way. That was that, and I was going somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to finagle my career then carefully to stay out of... He had several, quite a few books, mm-hmm. collections of papers on Wittgenstein and that mm-hmm. era of philosophy, and I needed to make sure I got out of his way. Mm-hmm.
That for his good or for yours?
My good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to go to SUNY Albany because I didn't want to be in his department, and I had this so. Pissed with my advisors at MIU when I got there. I'd go for an appointment in their office, and the first thing they'd say is, "How's Hal?"
Mm-hmm.
And I would fume and say, "Call him up yourself, you jerk. I'm your mentee. Let's chat." So that's when I took back my maiden name. Didn't do any good. They knew who he was anyway, but I could see the handwriting on the wall, and I better get an identity that was separate. No, he was very charming. We had a lovely time.
Harding is your...
maiden name, yeah. My children have a hyphenated name.
Mm.
Harding Warwick.
So clearly Harold was handsome, as you said. But what was... Can you remember more of, like, what did you imagine this young man was up to that was so attractive to you?
Well, he was very attentive. He was very loving. We did... played tennis every week. We did a lot of fun things around New York. He lived up with his parents at that point at like Amsterdam and across the street from Columbia, fundamentally. And I lived in the village. And he had some, you know, fun friends that we spent time with. And I had friends, and I don't know, we just had a good time together. And he didn't try to control me the way the various lawyers and doctors I was dating did. When push came to shove, they wanted to tell me how to fix my hair, how to dress, what to wear, what to say here, what to say there, and he had none of that. He wasn't into that. It was such a relief. I think that was a major thing.
Was there sort of a downtown-uptown distinction? Since you're coming from the village?
No.
Mm-mm.
I mean, he had been used to socializing in the village, and his friends lived mostly in the, his boyfriends lived mostly in the Columbia area.
Is Riverside Church, is that in the same?
Yes, it's a block away.
Okay, so he gets his doctorate.
We get married.
You get married in, when you're 23? So
right, and he
58.
Gets his, so let me see, and we got married, we moved to the Bronx. He started teaching, I can't exactly remember what college it was some rural college over in Jersey City, while he was writing his dissertation. And so how long do we live there? I mean, he didn't get his dissertation until, he took a long time. Everybody took a long time in those days. They don't permit that any longer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. I could figure out the dates if I sat down and did it. But we moved to Poughkeepsie in '64, so we were married in '58. Is that right? I graduated in '56. We were married in '58. We moved to Poughkeepsie in '64. And 66, taught at Vassar for 2 years, and I started having babies, and then in 66 we moved to SUNY Albany, and I think he got his PhD before we went to Vassar, or 1 year after, so he got his, he's a year and a half older than me, so he graduated in 55 from Brown University. And had started law school at Columbia and decided he didn't like it, and so he switched to philosophy. So 55, so 56 he started philosophy, and he got his degree in 65, probably.
Okay. Which is also the year your first daughter was born.
Yes.
And what's her name?
Dorian, D-O-R-I-A-N. She's a librarian at Yale.
Oh. And then the next year you had your second daughter.
Yeah, Emily. Emily's currently having a wonderful time being unemployed, but she and she's living off of her stockbroker's skills. But she and I and Eva, her daughter, lived together from when Eva was 5 months old until 2 years ago when they returned. I'm in deep sorrow at having. I mean, I grew up with this kid, right? She's. You'll hear more about this later, but she's got three more weeks to be 15, and then she starts college on August 14th. She's going 2 years early to college.
Wow.
Yes.
You weren't kidding about them. A long time back in the day.
I'm not kidding. I mean, so this is grandma talking, but you get it. So on her 6th and 7th grade statewide math tests in June, in 6th and 7th grade, on a scale of 1 to 500, they graded them.
Mm.
500.
Mm.
Both years. I don't know where this kid gets it. So they lived with me. It was wonderful. And Emily worked for a colleague at UCLA all those years managing grants. Education department at UCLA is the highest external grant recipient at UCLA except for the med school. I had many colleagues who had somewhere between $3 million and $15 million in grants running because everybody invests in education. So Emily was a kind of middle level employee of my colleague Carolee and managed grants there for 8 years. And then she when Eva started turning into a teenager, if you know what I mean, she decided she needed her old community back there in Northampton. She'd gone to Smith. She'd lived in Northampton for 20 years. She worked there after college. So to my great loss, they moved back, and then I sold that house and moved in here within a year. So I've been here 2 years, so she left 3 years ago. So I have an intense relationship with both of them and a good relationship with Dorian, which is lucky. It hasn't all, you know, they're always difficult, but...
Where is Eva going to college?
Simon's Rock, Bard at Simon's Rock?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know it?
Mm-hmm.
They invented early college, is what they say.
Ah, okay.
They've done it for 30 years. You know, Bard College is about an hour north of Manhattan. But Simon's Rock, their other campus, is up in Brattleboro, Massachusetts, I think.
Oh my God, yeah.
It's about an hour from where they live now in Northampton. So Eva will live on campus.
Mm-hmm.
This little kid, she's not little and she's not a kid, but 15?
Mm-hmm.
To me, she's still a little kid. She's had the formidable and a totally... disappointing task of trying to teach me trigonometry. I wish her a lot of luck, but it's not working very well.
So if we can go back to that,
yeah.
Those years, 65 and 66, when you had mentioned this was the first time since you were a young child that you weren't in school or working.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that was different for you.
Oh, it was
and
awful.
Aware of
it. I hated it.
You hated it.
I mean, I loved my babies,
yeah.
And I loved my husband, but that was not how I wanted to spend. And looking at my friends who were highly educated, I mean, you know, college graduates going crazy, teaching their kids to read at 3, oh my God, it just struck terror in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
This is not what I envisioned for myself, and I wasn't going to do it.
And what we today would call a helicopter parent. You didn't want to be the person who's just...
Not only a helicopter parent, it's a parent with no other life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a very frustrated generation of women. I mean, we weren't too far from the 50s, right, in 65, and it was still, not for me.
So you said when you got into NYU, you wanted to, earlier you said you wanted to have a separate identity
mm-hmm.
intellectually than your husband.
Mm-hmm.
How did that guide either the courses you took or the topics you chose to take interest in?
So he was in Wittgenstein, remained in analytic philosophy of that particular era. And I took a course in that, but I hated it. I mean, the minute the word Wittgenstein appeared, I noticed an allergic reaction. I typed that dissertation, I don't know, I say three times, I don't know if it was three times. It's a lot of typing. I loved my philosophy of science class, and I loved the logic classes. And I was moving through graduate school very fast because women like me were returning to college and having been managing households with a working husband and two kids. We could manage graduate school, it was easy. I mean, we had no problem. We knew how to organize our weeks to have time to get our work done. It was hard to do, but we knew how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to our peers in graduate school who were coming out of undergraduate school, they had no idea how to organize graduate work. We just stormed ahead. We knew what we were doing. It was kind of fascinating. When I was about to get my doctorate, one of my professors, whom I'd liked a lot, Rotzia Labelson, he said to me, and I am now 38, I think, he said, "Sandra, what are you leaving so soon for? We've hardly gotten to know you." Been there 5 years, right? While commuting from Albany, New York, right? That was the era. It was an era. So I just never went into his areas. And it wasn't... It was a conscious choice, because partly I didn't want to be where he was, partly I didn't want to think those people didn't interest me. I'd read his dissertations and his books and everything, and they weren't interesting to me to pursue. I mean, he was, in a way, an earlier, not a completely earlier generation, but so his dissertation was started in 50. Seven, did I say? Something like that. 56.
Mm-hmm.
And mine was started in 68. So it's a different era in philosophy. And a funny thing happened, yes. So NYU, how did this happen? They had for several years been advertising to hire an epistemologist in the graduate philosophy department. Maybe 2 or 3 years, they hadn't hired one. So they had all these great visitors from surrounding institutions come in and teach epistemology courses. So I took a terrific course with Henry Heege, who'd been Noam Chomsky's logic teacher. And it was, Noam Chomsky, right? I mean, who was already a political figure at this point. And... the course was a comparative study. So Henry Heege was Polish, and he's a generation older than Chomsky.
H-I-Z, correct.
H-I-Z. It was a comparative study of Quine's Word and Object, and I wrote my dissertation on Quine. And I forget the name of the book, but it was a Polish logician, a famous Polish positivist logician. I took a whole course subsequently on Polish logic with him. Who knew? I mean, it sounds like a bad joke, doesn't it? You know, it was a completely... I think this is very important for my career, actually. It's a kind of theme. You know, which reminds me... I'm just going to give you this. This is that other autobiographical essay that I ran into. This is your copy. This is the book it's in. It's mostly similar, but it's got some things in it that are a little different.
Thank you.
And I think I'm getting this from that essay. I don't think I thought it up now. I had to read it to pull it up again. That if there could be alternative logics, I mean, it was an alternative logic. It treated terms differently. Mm. If there could be alternative logics, then there could be alternative anything, right? I mean, if logic is not universal, and if there's not just one structure, appropriate structure, to how we think and organize thought, then any field could have another way of doing things. And I think that that experience, that kind of experience, I think I talk about that in this other autobiographical thing I found, I had in a number of ways. I think being an older student and having been trained into philosophy in an area that was not going to be mine, and then coming into another area, and I think that has stayed with me forever. I mean, here I am now living in a Jewish community, and I'm not Jewish, and I'm illiterate in Spanish and Portuguese, and I'm founding a Latin American studies journal. I mean, I know how it happened, but it doesn't look like a logical thing to happen. It is really different. And I think I've always been comfortable with that kind of contradiction. Mm-hmm. And I haven't tried to smooth it out. I mean, it's part of my philosophy not to smooth out those, not to get them all integrated, mm-hmm. but to keep their separate virtues and separate. I'm very clear about it with this Tapuya.
Mm-hmm. Taking a step back, so when you're at Albany, your husband is working in the philosophy department, you don't want to become your husband's student by going into that, so you go to sociology.
Exactly.
What was the interest in doing sociology? And second, you had mentioned elsewhere, you mentioned John Gunnell's.
Oh, yes, I did.
Image. And that it's through him that you encounter Kuhn,
yes.
and Klein.
Do you know Gunnell?
I don't. I don't know.
He's still a significant figure in political science.
Yeah. Could you give us why was sociology the...
Okay, so why sociology? I chose sociology with all the wisdom that a 16-year-old would choose a major. There I was coming from English, and I wasn't going to do English. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do philosophy, my husband's field. Mm-hmm. I thought, I like people. I'll go into sociology. Dude, that sociology part, they didn't like people. Mm. They like numbers.
Right.
And so I ended up, I'm saying that, but on the other hand, it's interesting in that in my whole entire teaching life, after year one, I've always had a joint appointment in the sociology department, including a joint appointment at the Graduate School of Education. There are only two philosophers out of 50 faculty. It's a completely social, it's economics of education, politics of education, ethnographies of some educational context. And so I think that movement between the two sides are both part of me, and I put them together in my own way, but I don't try to smooth out the dissonances between them. I don't know if that answers you.
You mentioned earlier about learning that you, the statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Was that this period? Or
that was the sociology. Yes, that was a requirement for sociology. Mm-hmm. That's how they let me into sociology, because I had no sociology background. I'd had one course in undergraduate school 15 years earlier. Mm-hmm. I said, if you let me in, I'll take the statistics course immediately, and if I flunk, okay. Mm-hmm. I did the same thing with NYU, because I had no background in philosophy. Mm-hmm. I'd taken one course as an undergraduate. Again, I said to them, if you let me in, I'll take the logic courses immediately. Mm-hmm. Most people put off the logic course. I've been grading my husband's logic papers for years. So those statistics and logic courses ended up a route for me.
Yeah.
I enjoyed them, and they got me into places that I might not otherwise have gotten.
So what are these decisions about the educational programs about curiosity or career?
And were my decisions?
Yeah, I mean, what did you imagine you were going to do with a graduate degree in sociology or philosophy?
Teach in a university department.
But not in your husband's university department?
Not in his department.
So what did you think would happen if you had a graduate degree in philosophy? You're at Albany.
Well, what happened? Okay, so here's what happened. So
I'm jumping ahead, I apologize.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
I first taught at a funky little leftover 1960s college that was part of SUNY Albany. It was called the Allen Center. And it was a social science early admissions. And I taught philosophy in it. My husband was uptown in the philosophy department. This was downtown, and it's a small little department. It was a separate little college, but it was tiny. I think we had 17 faculty, maybe. And I don't think I had a very clear idea what I would do, but it began not to be a problem because, so I got my dissertation in 73, I think it was. And by 74, so 73, 4, I was teaching at the Allen Center half-time. And 74, I got a full-time job at the Allen Center. The half-time moved to a full-time. So I could support my children, and I divorced. So then, that's 74. So I taught 2 more years until the Allen Center was shut down by the State University in procedures that last time I checked was 5 years ago. But it left SUNY Albany on the AAUP censure list for 35 years. They were the number one. Their procedures had been so bad, they just cut us all off. And there were other colleges going through similar kinds of processes where they weren't so bad. But I immediately got a job at the University of Delaware. We had divorced for 2 years. And it was very, he was not happy with it, but we were on friendly relations. The kids were, when we divorced in 74, so they were 8 and 9 in 74. So he lived, I don't know, a couple blocks away, and the kids were with him, and, you know, we worked it all out. He was a little bit aggressive about it, but not excessive. And within 3 weeks, he had moved in with a woman whom he didn't know 3 weeks earlier, when he left the house. I mean, he couldn't live without somebody there. And she became actually a wonderful second mother to my kid. She was the head of the journal, editor of the journal for the American Historical Association. Mm. And she and I, they split a long time ago, and he's been married for 20 years, and his youngest kid with Jeanette is 3 months older than his grandkid. Through our youngest daughter. I mean, his wife is 2 years younger than his youngest daughter. Anyway, we don't have to get into house. He's a very sweet guy, and he's doing fine.
Was part of getting the career, getting the degree, because you wanted to have that autonomy? Or you wanted to have the autonomy
so.
Possible?
I don't think so. We never fought a lot. We just outgrew each other. We were married for 17 years, I think it was. Because we were married something like 8 years before we had kids, something like that, I can't exactly remember. We kind of just outgrew each other in different ways. And have remained amicable to this day. I have dinner with him every year or so at the American Philosophical Association.
if I could ask Jody's question in a different way, is what do you think you were going to, why were you doing what you were doing?
I know you keep asking that and I keep not answering it.
Because I can remember what I thought I was doing when I was in undergraduate and then grad school. It was always a little different. But there was some emerging image of who I thought I was going to become.
I think that's because you're a guy.
Is it?
I don't know. I don't think I had an image of what I wasn't going to be. But I don't think I had a very positive image of what grasp of what I was going to do. I mean, the first time that happened was when I went back in philosophy, or sociology, I suppose, because then I was going to teach, and I knew what that would be like and so forth. But before that, I didn't.
Your friend Gloria, who was an inspiration for going to grad school, so it almost seems like she was the example of the one that got away.
Yes.
And you wanted to get away too.
Yes.
So again, it was retreat, it was escaping,
yes.
Not going towards something. Is that
yes.
Fair?
Yes. She was married to a very distinguished psychiatrist. He had been one of the people who did the closing down the mental institutions. He'd been a leader in that. I forget the name of the guy who really did it, but he was the second to do that. He was a crazy guy. And she was at the point when she was going back to graduate school. She had two kids who were a little bit older than mine, Crazy Dan, and his parents and her father living on the third floor, these aged. She was taking care of all of these exceedingly needy people, and she went back to grad school. She was sick of this too, but he burned a cross on her lawn when she went back to grad school. I mean, really. I always felt kind of, Hal never did anything like that, so hey,
yeah.
I was getting all easy in those days. And, so I think it was an era when I until I got into that familiar academic context, I couldn't really imagine a life for myself. I mean, I saw possible lives in those New York jobs, but they weren't, I didn't hate them, but they weren't anything I aimed for. I mean, I just tried to be a good secretary or whatever my title was, and had my own social life and so forth going on. I'm sorry to sound so, I know you hope there's some secret.
No, I don't think it's a hope. I think it takes so many turns, I wonder at what point. Is there a time when you so you're clearly maximizing each situation?
I'm trying. That's good.
And I think that is amazing. I think that's what a lot of people do. I think we tell ourselves that we have some sort of intent, but I don't want to lose the intent if there starts to be one.
I think it doesn't start until I get into a place where I can envision something. I couldn't envision. What could I envision when I was working in the Keating Lecture Bureau or ABC. I could envision ABC. There were people in higher ranks, and I could see how that was attractive to do, and maybe I'd end up doing that, but it wasn't where I needed much more skills and experience to do it. They were considerably older than me. That could have been, but meanwhile, we took a trip to Europe, and I had to quit that job, and when we came back, I worked elsewhere. I just think I don't think I did it. I always had huge energy for whatever I was doing, but it was evidently not focused in any understandable way until I got into a world that I knew very well, because I'd been socialized into it through my husband. I knew exactly what university life was. He taught at that New Jersey college, then he'd been to Columbia the philosophy department. He taught at Vassar, he was teaching at SUNY, and I knew what those job changes had been about and what his challenges had been, and I'd graded his papers, and I knew all his colleagues, and it was a very familiar and easy, kind of easy thing to imagine, and there was nothing else I was imagining. I just knew I did not want to turn into those kinds of crazed mothers.
Do you want to say something about Gunnel and what you gained from?
Yes. So the year I was back in sociology, let me see. Is this true that I knew him socially already? I think I knew him socially already through friends in political science. He was in the political science department, Jack Connell. And he was teaching a graduate seminar on Marx and Quine or something like that, I can't remember. But it was a political, there were about 10 of us in it. He let me get into it. I mean, it was my first year in graduate school and must have been hungry for students in the class. He let me into it because they were all political theorists in that class. And it was very exciting. I loved the format of writing papers and sitting around a table, and really interesting ideas. And that's what led me to start when that sociology at SUNY Albany fell apart, to start looking for the courses in sociological theory at NYU. And then my wise decision to make that bus trip once a week.
Instead of twice a week. Because Kuhn is sort of a recurring character.
Kuhn, I'm sorry, that's what it was. It was Quine and Kuhn.
Yeah, right.
That's what it was. It was Quine and Kuhn.
Did Kuhn figure in your imagination at that time? Did you read Kuhn as well, or was this just his?
Wait a minute. Is that right? I'm sorry. Now I can't remember. Or was Kuhn the next year when I got to NYU, because I remember when we brought up the topics from Kuhn to Richard Martin. He's my adored logic teacher. He said that was just ephemera, it would disappear, and we weren't going to talk about it. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Kuhn was the next year.
I saw that in the printout you just gave, he says.
Piece
of ephemera, so you and the rest of the students read it on your own.
Yes, we immediately formed a Kuhn studied group and started talking about it. If he wasn't going to talk about it at all, there must be something important there. So I forget exactly the focus of the Gunnel seminar. It seems it couldn't have been Marx. Was it? I'm sorry, I can't remember. But it was, whatever it was really exciting to me.
It seems like in this note that we have that the students had already read Kuhn, and so the course was focused on Quine's Word and Object. Does that sound about right?
You know, that sounds about right. The two courses are getting mixed in my mind. They're a year apart, and one's at SUNY Albany and one's down.
Reading Quine.
There, and then there's the Quine and Polish Logic course the following year. So over 3 years.
A lot of Quine.
It was a lot of Quine. I think we only read him in two of those courses, so I can't exactly remember what we were reading in Gunnel. I do remember the excitement about Kuhn. It was very exciting.
When you took the faculty position, did you think that you would keep up kind of a line of research, or that you were going to... Did you think that the line of inquiry you were developing in the dissertation is something that you were going to continue to pursue? Or did you imagine the faculty position as much more of kind of a teaching line?
Oh, no, I intended to write. This is where I have to look at my CV to tell you what was happening. When I look at the books, the oldest book there is 76, Can Theories Be Refuted? Essays on the Duhem-Quine Thesis. That came directly out of my dissertation. My dissertation was on the Duhem-Quine Thesis.
And that's pretty quickly after your dissertation.
Right. I immediately published that. And then the next thing, I love writing and love doing research. And then there was that special issue. Then 1983, Merrill Hintikka and I, when we come to the Science Wars, this is the beginning of the Science Wars story. I'll give you the first piece of it here. We had decided to put together this collection of feminist epistemology, metaphysics, methodology, and philosophy of science papers. And I think I mentioned, did I mention she was married to Jaakko Hentikka, who was a very famous, powerful philosopher, analytic philosopher, and logician. He was from Finland. And he held two very powerful positions. He was chairman of the board of the journal Synthesa. And he was the editor-in-chief of the same publisher book series called Synthesa Library. So he had promised Meryl and me a special issue of Synthesa. And when the board heard the title, Discovering Reality, Feminist Perspectives, and so forth, they ran amok. Three of them threatened to quit if that was published, and one of them said, I suppose they're going to have on the cover a photograph of Betty Friedan waving her bra. It was a crisis. And so he gave us, he was very annoyed, he was very feminist. He gave us a volume in the Synthesa Library series, and that's what this is. It's volume 83 in the series. So that was the second book, and then I started developing, the Science Question in Feminism was the first big monograph. I was writing all the time. There's a lot of essays. I list the essays. I'm lecturing, and my work was so. When we moved to this, I know we're supposed to be back in the past more, but this is the beginning of that science wars narrative that has immensely shaped everything about my life, the institutions I work in, the kinds of projects I work on, and in my mind, it's central to the founding of STS. That we, Donna and I, and Evelyn Fox Keller to some extent, along with Latour and Simon and Schaffer, were the first big targets of criticism by physicists. Of course, they hated the idea of feminist epistemology and philosophy of science, but they hated the idea of any social studies of physics or chemistry or biology. And so I think this Science Wars story is a very important one for the understanding the formation of, if you just take it as a discipline, the things we call disciplines were mostly created in the 19th century. This is one of the rare ones that gets created later. Maybe not so rare, but it's certainly different from history or philosophy and so forth. And it's hugely contentious from the minute critics of Kuhn, Lakatos and Musgrave, Volume and Popper. Kuhn and what's his name? Britt.
Hacking?
Science and its problems.
Hacking?
No, Hacking.
No, Lab?
No. Science and its social problems. It's a couple years before Kuhn. I can't think of his name. He's not that prominent. He didn't become that prominent, but it's a Kuhnian kind of clear focus on science and technology in culture. And I think, this Science Wars thing streams through my whole CV in kinds of ways that were at the time challenging, but I don't think my career has suffered in kinds of ways that I regret because of it. But I've had a whole series of this kind of situation I'm telling you, where the editors say they'll quit if my work is published. And I'll tell you something. I got turned. CNRS withdrew a invitation to be a visiting professor for, I forget whether it was 3 weeks or 6 weeks, whatever. They offered it to me, and then they wrote back and apologized. They couldn't do it anymore because so-and-so had come out. The head of NSF, of our division, I'm visualizing him, and I've lost his name.
Fred Kranz.
Pardon?
Fred Kranz.
No, it's be earlier. Before that. This would be in the 1970s. I had had an NSF summer fellowship. And the next year I applied for something or other, a semester off fellowship or something. And he called me up and told me he was so sorry, but he couldn't afford to give me any kind of funding in the future because he was scrutinized all the time by the right wing. And if he published me, NSF would be damaged. So I continued reviewing for him, you know, for years, but I couldn't get any funding. I mean, and so that kind of story, yes, it's about me, but I think it's mostly about STS. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was me individually, anybody who wrote on those topics. Mm-hmm. The feminists were an easy target at first. And to me, what's interesting also, I'll just put this out there. So it was about 15 years of attacks on me and Donna and Evelyn Keller and Latour. And then it kind of ended. And that was when the anti-racist and the post-colonial accounts were beginning to appear. And these were senior foreign men. And these white physicists were not about to get into struggles with Indian or Latin American or African leading figures in their country. It's one thing to attack junior, Don and I were very junior at that point, and so was Evelyn Keller. It's one thing to attack us. I mean, Latour is French, you know, the French are always open for sober people's attacks, right? But, I think that history has something to do with, I'm trying not to be self-serving, but I never even took it totally personally.
Yeah.
I always thought it was part of the attacks on feminism and part of the discomfort with the social, with the idea that sciences and their societies co-constitute each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's just discomfort with that physicists and chemists and biologists and eventually some of the sociologists. I got huge attacks from empirical sociologists. So anyway, I forget how we got into that, but
I don't recall either. What do you think? I mean, I'm sure we'll dive more into it, but just to keep the thread for a moment, what is the source of that discomfort?
Excuse me,
sure.
And I have a reservation for us at 5:15, so I'll make a call downstairs in a few minutes. They'll hold it.
A moment. What